I'm Jacob Kinberg, and you are listening to Salty Cinema. Today on the show, I am talking to my good friend Mitch Gonzalez. We have known each other since we were 8 years old. He is a visual effects supervisor, animator, artist, really talented guy. He's worked on huge films, Pan, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Noah, Chronicle, Red Tails, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, Hugo, Fast Five, just huge movies. So we're talking visual effects with him. Last night was the Oscars. Had a great party over here at the Kinberg house with the nacho bar and prizes. We competed for a Chick-fil-A gift card. And I'm happy to say that I did win the Chick-fil-A gift card. That was really fun. If you had followed the advice of my friend Alex and I, you would have done pretty well last night. I think it, with our picks combined, we only got a couple wrong. The surprise of Best Picture being Green Book was big. I did not expect that. I didn't think Green Book was bad, but Best Picture, I don't think so. But you know, what are you gonna do? The Oscars are the Oscars, and you know, there's no accounting for taste. Am I right, people? Anyway, we're talking visual effects today, and I recently saw Alita: Battle Angel, and I really liked it. Actually, I wasn't expecting a lot going in. I love James Cameron. I love Robert Rodriguez. I thought they would do something interesting together, and they really did. It was a fun, exciting action movie with pretty spectacular visuals. It's a treat for the eyes. So I recommend going to see it. And the visual effects were amazing. So yeah, go check it out. Let's get to my conversation with visual effects extraordinaire Mitch Gonzalez. I am sitting here in Simi Valley, California, with my best friends of all time, Mitch Gonzalez.
How's it going?
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I've known Mitch since I was 8 years old playing Mortal Kombat at his house.
Good game. Blood mode.
When's the last time you played Mortal Kombat?
Oh, man. I can't even remember. It's been quite a while. I haven't even pulled out the Sega Genesis since probably...
But you have it here?
I do, yeah. Oh,
nice.
It's in storage.
We went to school together from, I guess, you were at K through 12, right? I mean, you were at Diamond Path.
We met like second grade?
Yeah.
I was at second grade.
Let's just get right into it. When did you know that you wanted to do something in the entertainment industry?
I guess it was probably around the time Jurassic Park came out, and I kind of understood that dinosaurs weren't real then, but I thought they looked real, and I wanted to know.
You were seven.
Yeah, it
was 93, like, right? 93. That's when. Yeah, I remember seeing it in theaters.
Yeah, I saw it in theaters. I remember actually seeing it twice, once with my family and then my grandparents, because it was such a big blockbuster movie that we ended up going again. And I was watching my grandparents' reaction when the big Velociraptor scary moment happened, and it was comedy to just watch them jump because I knew it was coming. But it was I remember watching that. It was after that when the seed, I guess you could say, was planted, I was always kind of fascinated with entertainment, acting and magic, and just getting laughs, just kind of class clown kind of person. So entertainment was kind of like the ultimate pursuit, I guess, but I didn't quite know until, I guess it was really high school, like sophomore year, when I knew for sure that I wanted to go into visual effects as far as a career.
But like in high school, we weren't having, like I was always talking about wanting to be a filmmaker. And you would, we would do stuff together, but I don't remember you, like, we weren't like making plans about going to California together, or like, I never got it from you that you wanted to like work in the industry until later. Were you thinking about it in high school though? Like,
yeah, I think for me, it was in the back of my mind that when I found out where movies were made, that's just kind of where I knew I was eventually going to be. I didn't even say it to my family, really. I just did it because I kind of just assumed that was what's going to...
What were you saying, though? Like, if people were asking you before you went to... Because you ended up staying and doing, like, community college and a technical... It was, like, a technical art school, right? What were you saying in high school to people asking you, what do you think you're gonna do for a job?
In high school, I already knew and had committed. It was almost like freshman year was my way of breaking into it, because at that point I had started dabbling in 3D with architectural programs like 3D Studio Max, like it was discrete Max, and it was more like AutoCAD, but I was using it for visualization. And then the high school, you know, Eastview High School, where we went to, was, you know, amazing technology program, and they had access to all these just digital programs that you know, included all of the, you know, Adobe Suite with like Photoshop, editing, website stuff, and then they had the 3D applications, but no one really knew how to use it. But I did, because I had done it on my own, and also took like just like a workshop. That's really kind of like where I had started. It was like, hey, you can do 3D stuff. It was 3D, but it wasn't like, it was 3D multimedia. It wasn't 3D for film, but I knew how it translated right away. But what I was telling people was like, I'm gonna go into visual effects, because I knew at that point I was old enough. I knew what it was. I knew it was a career. I knew you could, you know, I had researched it enough to know that it was a viable option for career. Because at that point, when you're kind of a sophomore, people might not be thinking about it. Thankfully, I was like fortunate enough to understand that college is right around the corner, and that like high school is the time to figure that out. So I really jumped on that pretty early on. But when I was younger, I was always into art. So it was a beautiful combination of bringing art, what I loved about art, and entertainment together. And that's kind of how that happened.
Why do you think you didn't go the route of more like performance?
Actually, I was talking to this with a mentee, because I was part of a mentor program for the college, and they asked me the influence of acting, and like if that was something that was really something they needed to pursue in kind of like tandem with animation specifically. And the question came up like, did you ever pursue it, or like what happened? And for me, acting is what was more important to the acting was like understanding just what works and what doesn't work as far as motion and what is realistic or what is not realistic. So it wasn't so much the, I guess, the emotion of acting, but I loved entertaining, and that just came so natural to me. So like acting was, I could shut it off, my like ability to try and kind of just entertain in a way that was forced. It was just like, I'm naturally just entertaining because I believed in that. But it switched when I was in high school. Acting became a lot harder because of like ego and pride and all these things that came up. So like I wasn't able to shut it off as easily. It was kind of like this, what I was able to do so naturally before just kind of stopped because of, you know, wanting to create this, you know, good persona. Yeah, this persona that was like a, you know, not a screwball goofy kind of person, but that still was inside of me. So,
you know, yeah. What's funny about you saying that, I felt like somehow I had an influence in making you less silly and crazy. Like I had like you brought out that in me, I think, in middle school. And I felt like I had the opposite effect on you. Like I was like making you more
mellowed me out.
Yeah. But it makes sense that, because I had the same kind of feeling of going to high school and like that freshman year, I felt like I lost all confidence and like that was like the worst year. And I didn't really know why that happened, but.
Yeah, it was definitely a similar thing. Because in like middle school, eighth grade, like we were just like complete class clowns. But not that we got in trouble. It was just like pushing the boundary all the time because it was like, what it was funny was like we screwed around and we fooled around all the time, but we were like getting straight A's and like just got it. You know, we got what school was. And then, you know, high school kicked it up a notch as far as like homework and projects and importance. And then all of a sudden, like it became something that was more, I guess, like on path to like your adulthood. And so like that, I know that's kind of when after, I know for sure, probably like around freshman year is like kind of that same thing. I don't know if it happened right away, but I do remember taking an acting class when I was younger and someone pulling me aside and really asking me like, you know, where did you learn this? Like how, you know, like are you taught in any other kind of way? And I was just kind of like confused. I was like, no, this is actually my first acting class. Mm-hmm. And like, they actually spoke to my mom and they were like, you know, you should, you know, your son should pursue acting more. Something about that really kind of turned me off from acting. It was weird. It was almost like they didn't understand what I was really therefore. It was like, you need to go into acting because you're good at it. And I saw it as, you need to go into acting because it's now your job.
And that's interesting.
Yeah. And I was like, I kind of sucked the fun out of what I wanted it to be. So I was like, you know, it didn't take long to where I just realized acting was more of a hobby, is more of like, you know, this is fun and enjoyable, but I don't, you know, I don't really want to make it a career. I guess I understood really what acting was at a young age. It wasn't just screwing around or whatever. Yeah. It was
there
like
was work to it.
Yeah. There was a lot of work and I was never good at memorizing lines. And I remember another time in fifth grade where I was for some reason I was like, I don't know if you remember, this is like a play. I forgot what play it was, but I was cast as the number two role in it, as like high as you could go. Uh-huh. And who got number one was Alex Joy. I don't know if you remember Alex Joy. Yeah. Really smart kid. One of like the smartest kids that I remember kind of going to school.
Yeah.
And the only reason why he got one and I got two is because he could remember all of his lines, but he wasn't as good an actor. And so
what grade did
you spit? Fifth grade.
So it would have been the, I think I have video of that one.
So some, I was like a dead king and.
I know. I can't remember what it's called, but.
I can't remember either.
I had a part in it, but I wasn't.
Yeah, it was. And I remember tryouts. I had to act all these different reactions to watching a movie, and like Mrs. Oliver was like sitting there with like the music teacher, I can't remember her name, and she was like, is like, you know, directing me through this. And while she was directing, I was like acting it out. Do you remember kind of doing that?
And Mrs. Oliver, that name I had forgotten, but so she pulled me in third grade to be in a like local video that they were making for the school district. That was my first time like acting on camera.
Yeah, that was another kind of like aha moment where I was like, I do so much better when I'm like, I'll get a script, but like I was so much better at just ad-libbing and just like improvising. And like, I feel like there was much more, and I wasn't, it was like stick to a script. It was nice though, cause she was really, definitely like helpful in like wanting to bring out the best. It was like, I never got that vibe, but when I went to a workshop that was supplemental to that, it was like only say the lines. Like I was kind of reprimanded for not like saying the lines right. And I think that's why like I stopped, because I was like, I don't like how rigid this is. Like, I like it to be a little bit more, you know. And it was, is, you know, that combination of high school and then just stopped, I think, the interest in acting.
Why didn't you do the film career development course with me? Like junior and senior year, where I would go to Rosemont.
Oh, I did.
You did?
But I stopped because of the, I remember I started, but I had like some conflict with schedule. And then I also, I took one class, but I went into the 3D side. It was straight up 3D with.
So you were able to do a career development thing that was just 3D.
Yeah, it was specifically for 3D. Again, it was every 3D class I had taken prior to going to college and learning, it was a complete waste of time. It was everything that I already knew. I was taking it because I had access to the software, to the programs. And it wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even something that was, but that's definitely what it was. It was like, it could have either gone into video production, which you did was more directing, shooting, editing, or go complete 3D, which I did. And it was with Dan. I was like, senior year.
Okay.
Where you could drive.
I remember that.
You could drive off. Yeah.
I remember you were really into horror when we were younger. Has that kind of gone away, or is that something you still have interest in, horror films and just?
Well, I think I was always into horror because it was kind of like taboo, and it was like really creative, and it was interesting because you just don't see a lot of it. But obviously, as being a Christian, a lot of that changed just with understanding there's a demonic realm,
and you didn't want to celebrate that.
It was like, okay, probably.
Is that why you liked horror? It wasn't because of horror.
No, I think I liked horror just because it was fun and fascinating. Most like why kids like Halloween. It's just like, you know, it seems like harmless, and like getting scared is like kind of fun sometimes.
Well, I just always loved dressing up as something. It was like getting to play act.
Yeah.
You know, it had nothing to do with anything like sinister, or like the stuff I would dress up as was like characters from, I remember going as the Mask, Jim Carrey, like stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I gravitated towards that genre really early on. I mean, I loved Halloween. I loved the whole concept of just, you know, goblins and ghouls and pumpkins, and I don't know. It was really, it wasn't like unhealthy. I found out later, you know, like looking back, if I look at it, I'm like, dude, this kid has got issues, but it was like totally normal. And it wasn't like, you know, I'd be like, but not only that, but it was like, it was an outlet for sure for me as far as like violence went.
Okay.
So like drawing violent things was the same way as if, you know, like I was processing violence in a healthy way. And like most people, you know, might, you know, thankfully I was not like put in a position where I was labeled as like, this person's got issues, because it could have easily been, especially with the school I went to. I think one time I might have gotten like, my mom was showing something that I drew, and it was very violent, like arms getting hacked off. And like, you know, I drew stuff from Mortal Kombat. So like the pit with all these bodies hanging and everything. Yeah. But it was, at the end of the day, it was like, I'm not, the behavior wasn't there. Uh-huh. So it wasn't justified, you know, and I'm really thankful that it wasn't like, this kid needs to be like psychoanalyzed and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But I mean, I was like someone you'd think of as like, if this kid isn't watched, he probably could end up with trouble, because like, I would hurt animals when I was a kid. I was like violent. Like, I was like
the classic case.
Yeah, exactly. Classic stuff. But there are some things that are like, that's kind of normal boyish kind of stuff to do. Because again, like, there wasn't like, when I did something wrong, I knew it was wrong. When I like, you know, it wasn't like a bad record, like serial thing. There's like stuff that I would do, but it was more like dumb stuff, like lighting stuff on fire and, you know, breaking and entering in places or doing stuff that was just like, you know,
harmless but still illegal.
Like troublemaking stuff, but not like, like, there were lines that I had that it's like, no, I'm not gonna, I kind of stay away from drugs, I kind of stayed away from you know, all, anything that was like, I'm either gonna harm someone or harm someone else. If it was like, you know, kind of like what you said, like petty stuff, like if it was like, you know, getting a rush, adrenaline rush from like escaping from someone or something, or, you know, breaking into somewhere that I shouldn't be, you know, but that there, again, like there's some outlets that I feel like I walked into that were just like, probably not the best choice, but they, at least they were healthier than going down another path. But yeah, I mean, there were things that were working on as far as like you mellowing me out, was that you had a good foundation, a good head on your shoulders that was like, you know, I really, you know, appreciated that. It was like a respect thing where it was like, you know, this is a, we see eye to eye on certain things, but like, it's not like out of control. Like, the, what you were doing had reason behind it. That was like, oh, that's, you know, I'm I'm okay with that. So like, if you would kind of break the rules a little, then I would like, all right, that's okay. Like, I can kind of push it. But then you had like great reasoning around why you wouldn't do things. I was like, that makes sense. You know, like, I don't want to hurt someone or hurt myself or like hurt my family or like those kind of things. So I think that, I don't know how I brought out the crazy in you. Maybe just,
well, just like
being around you
opened me up, like, to, I don't know. Like, I've always been someone that who I'm around can change what side of me kind of comes out, you know, like certain people I can be around that will just kind of shut me down and I'll become super quiet, and other people just bring out my like outgoing party kind of side. So, okay. So, but, so visual effects, your interest in art being kind of the main driver and saying, okay, I love doing this, but instead of being a painter or artist, my love for entertainment is gonna, that's kind of what brought you to say, okay, I like working in this realm for film in particular. Like, why aren't you just an artist, I guess is my question.
I realized, you know, just doing something 2D on a piece of paper was really kind of limited. So like, the idea of making something 3D or bringing something to life was the most, you know, driving force, I guess, passion that came out. It's like when you can create something that is kind of like you're giving life to something, whether it's, you know, an inanimate object that you're making move, or what was really, I was really passionate about is kind of where Jurassic Park laid the seed, was the fact that you could trick someone into thinking that this was real. So that was really where the ultimate passion was, and using art as the art form to do that was what, you know, was interesting to me.
Let's run through some of the highlights of films that you've worked on and what have been some of your favorite experiences, and what do you look at so far as the highlights?
The highlight, I guess the first big highlight was, so after I came out to California, it was literally like, it was just, I couldn't, there were so many, a lot more opportunities, a lot of jobs. I was turning jobs down. There were so many jobs at one point.
And you're doing a lot of previs. That's what you did for Chronicle, right?
Yeah, there was, so I was introduced, and this was before previs was like, previs was kind of more treated as a necessary step to lay out in 3D for animation. So it was like a means to end to get to the animation part, the fun part. So it's kind of like you needed to start somewhere with like a camera and 3D positioning, just basic 3D cinematography, before you could start animating. So you kind of needed to like block it out, lay it out. And that's basically what previs was, is taking storyboards and bringing them into the 3D world. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, something, a whole step that we learned in school, the importance of it, what it was for and all that. So yeah, naturally it was part of doing the job. And I started doing, you know, previs for Chronicle after the double. The double was just kind of like a quick kind of visual effects, like shots, a few shots that were cool. It was interesting. It was more cool because it was like just working in a studio with other creatives and having that whole vibe. Plus I got to end up working with you at some point too, because it like
we're in the same space.
Yeah, same building. So that was cool. And it was like not long after we'd been out here, and that was like something we were like, that, dude, so, what if we, yeah. I know, that's so bizarre. It was just like, dude, let's go get lunch. But so like after, let's see, so then just kind of like a real quick fast track.
Yeah.
The double kind of led into working with on a previs for Chronicle, which was for 20th Century Fox. And that was like a superhero live action we did previs for. And that only lasted maybe like a couple of weeks or something for me. And then I got a job offer for... the biggest, I guess, highlight then would come was when I got an offer from a company called Pixel Mondo, and they hired me for a George Lucas film. And I was like, what? And then it was like, oh, this movie. It was like
the movie no one remembers.
Yeah, the movie no one really cares about. But it was Red Tails. But it was cool to be like, hey, I'm working on a George Lucas film. And like he would send emails, so it was cool to say, oh, I got an email from George Lucas. And but that was the first kind of highlight, working on a George Lucas film. He ended up co-directing, or kind of just falling off the directing anyways, but he was associated with the film. But that company, I ended up coming on as, it was, I guess it was definitely still freelance. So it was still independent contract, but I was getting paid. I wasn't invoicing them. I was just on their payroll. So I was kind of introduced to what like permalance looked like, whereas like you're with a company, we don't have an end date, but we know we want to keep you for as long as this project goes. And we don't know how long that's going to be. It's kind of wishy-washy. And that was really when I kind of learned a lot about being freelance, what the different aspects of that look like. And that moved into, like, they rolled me on to the next film, which was Fast Five. So that was like a pretty cool highlight of that was I got to do stunt work for Vin Diesel in the film for a body replacement, face replacement. So I had to get to go and I got to go to set and like jump out in front of a green screen and a car. I don't know if you remember, that. And so then,
I think that was the first time of me going to a theater. I remember going and watching that, and seeing your work on the big screen was Fast Five.
Yeah, I think I remember I didn't even know if I was going to get credit for that film because you had to kind of like with VFX people, you kind of had to have worked on it for a certain period of time. And, you know, every name up on the screen costs money because it's, you know, footage that's being printed on film that's cost money to roll. So it's that's kind of fascinating how that works out. But I ended up, my name was on there to surprise. It was really cool. But that was a really cool highlight. So I, you know, dressed like Vin Diesel at the time. I had the build of Vin Diesel enough to where it was like, it didn't, you know, I didn't have to worry about my head or my hair or anything. It was just the action. And then after that, I was same with Pixel Mondo. I rolled down to Hugo, which was a really, you know, highlight that was so unexpected. So I was working for this company, Pixel Mondo, like I said, and like I never heard of them before. They weren't really like a big company. I found out that they were up and coming. They were like growing and expanding. I was like, dude, this is a great company to work with. I remember at one point you were like, dude, you could just work for them the rest of your life. I was like, yeah. And so like they ended up doing the visual effects for and the previs for Hugo, the whole film. Very rare that a studio like that size gets the whole film to themselves. Like they probably farmed out some stuff, but they like the VFX supervisor for the film was at the studio working on it. And I was kind of like, oh, it's a Martin Scorsese film. I was like, it's kind of interesting. You know, it's, it looks
Did you get to work with him directly?
The director?
Scorsese.
Oh, Scorsese. No, Scorsese was never there. I worked with
the
VFX supervisor, really cool guy, down to earth. He ended up starting his own studio after the success of this film with a team of people that he was with.
Real quick, so you're saying, you know, usually on big VFX heavy movies, you have multiple houses that are taking different scenes so that they can get it done quicker instead of just one company handling everything. I've been curious about how in that process they can have uniformity of what is being created when you have so many different companies trying to do visual effects that will seamlessly go together. How does that work?
There's always one person calling the shots at the end of the day. So there is a, you know, final look that they're going for and it's,
and that's set by the VFX supervisor. He's like,
That's definitely his job is to make sure all that, you know, comes together nicely. I mean, it's pretty rare, especially with the talent that's out there, that things get so far off that it's noticeable. Most of the time, only the artists can notice that.
Like, I was going to say, so when you're watching something, can you tell, like, oh, well, yeah, I can tell that shot was done by a different
definitely team. And it doesn't, it, you know, like you can tell, you know, there's a lot of times in the compositing that these are like B shots that just needed to get done, whereas there's not enough time to give it that extra level that it needed. But yeah, there's definitely on the big visual effects heavy films, if I know that it was split up into multiple different studios, I'll notice that a lot more commonly. But you know, it's getting harder and harder just because I think the final output of the films are just, the quality is just going higher and higher. Yeah. So harder to tell, but it's still there.
Do you feel like there's a place that VFX will get that it doesn't really need to get better? Like it reaches some kind of, I don't know, ultimate that it can be, or, and then the returns are just less.
We've already kind of experienced that in different ways, different things like
water can't get better.
Yeah. I guess it's just, you know, the last 1% is kind of what we call it, is like, is it worth it? Cause at some point there's just like a diminishing return where it's like, you're putting in all this extra effort and money and time, and it doesn't get you anything more that's going to matter. But I feel like we've gotten there at so many different levels as far as VFX go. There's so many things that, you know, like, you know, that just doesn't make sense to do visual effects, where shooting it practically makes much more sense and much more depth and realism than VFX ever could, even though the VFX is there. There's also...
So has there been a reverse of where, like, we were trying to do this VFX, but it's actually better just to
shoot like it? Like there's films that are purposefully pushing the agenda of we are the VFX to beat, and then you watch the film and it's like you can tell it's really heavy-handed in the visual effects. Some people love it, but it starts to become a tone, a style that is like, you know, for example and this might not be the best example, but something that comes to the top of my head is like I'll just say this one. So the new reboot of the Star Trek films, there was definitely a VFX style that was being pushed. And that was, you know, this gritty VFX, like visual effects isn't clean anymore. It's got like dirt and grime and just like, you know, explosions and the lens flares dirtying up the lens. Like all these shots are just like, they're purposefully trying to make this more organic looking and not so sterile. I mean, that's the thing, is like you can get visual effects look so real that it doesn't look real anymore because it's so clean and pristine and nice looking and perfect. And like you notice, you're like, that looks really good, but something's not right about that. Like Star Wars Episode One, like that was, everything was brand spanking new, straight out of the hangar, and these fights. And it was pretty rare that you had stuff that was like,
it wasn't lived in.
Yeah. And so during that time, I know that that was definitely a style. They're, you know, really heavy handed on the, you know, like we were always told like lens flares are such a just hokey thing. Like, just don't do lens flares. Whatever you do, don't do a lens flare in your demo reel. It was like something that was just, you don't do that. You won't get a job if you do lens flares. And then you watch this director who's like, the whole movie is everything's a lens flare. But it was how he was doing the lens flares and the you know, it was VFX lens flares that wanted to seem natural. So you know, that's what the appreciation was, shooting this thing in a way for the VFX to seem very organic and real, even though you knew there were visual effects. Like everyone knew that this was going to be a visual effects film, being in space and everything. But you start to appreciate the style that is like, you kind of get lost in the realism of it because of that. And if you're not looking for it, you definitely don't notice it. You feel it. And that's really what it was meant for. So yeah, there's definitely aspects that we're already in. As far as like honing back the visual effects, trying to bring in more of the practical. But there's also times where you're just like, dude, you are crazy to try and shoot this practically. Like you're trying to preserve the smallest piece of the set just to say that you're using something practical, when it's like you could have wiped the whole thing. The camera would have been digital and it would have just saved so much hassle. And a lot of times right now, the fight in the industry is, you know, when to draw the line, like with you thinking you're going to save money, as far as like budgeting for films, trying to do films on the cheap, because it's right now for visual effects, and it has been for a while. The industry is, it's a race to the bottom is what it's been described as, like how, like we want the best visual effects for the cheapest amount of money. And that just crushes the industry in a way that it's like, it's not, definitely not sustainable. But it just, like with any natural kind of evolution process, like things will die off, companies will go bankrupt, people will realize like we can't do it this way anymore, we can't pay people like this and get the consistent you know, effect that we want, or the consistent quality that we need or want, or people are wanting. Like the level of visual effects has gotten to a place where it's, where, you know, I mean, they, even in some films that are, you know, VFX films, like say Jurassic Park, it still to a certain extent lives up to the test of like, is this, you know, good visual effects? And a lot of it was way ahead of its time, visual effects. But, you know, there's certain films that really set the bar and, you know, in a lot of ways holds up with visual effects that you just can't kind of compete or deny.
So with visual effects all across the board being at a certain level, do things still stand out to you? Certain films like that do something that's above what everyone else is doing and kind of still, you know, make you impress you as a visual effects artist?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that people like there's still trying to perfect the art of digital doubles that are just 3D characters that are real looking. Like, it's the, you know, in animation, they have this saying that's the uncanny valley of where you start realizing you're like, something is just off. Like, it's not right. You know, like you're right in this weird place of where it's like, it looks real, but there's something about it that's dead and soulless and just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So it's either you push it to an extreme, like, you know, cartoony characterized stuff, or you, you know, go way below and you're like 2D animation kind of stuff. So there's this weird thing, like, you know, for example, like probably the most evident one of it was when they were trying to push it was the Polar Express. Mm-hmm. And along the lines, you know, Beowulf was there where it's full 3D characters that are supposed to look, you know, real. And they still got a ways to go on a lot of that. They've made a, you know, amazing progress, and it's always exciting to see that. There's definitely times where you're like, wow, that's like really, really good, but then like for a split second you're like, oh, I just lost it. And it's like a lot of the time it's in the eyes, and but that's getting better now with a lot of technology. But it's it really brings up this amazing phenomenon that I feel like is totally underrated and not appreciated, is how the human eye is able to pick stuff up just naturally, knowing like, oh, that's fake. Like the normal person, there's like, could just be like, oh, that's, there's something about it that's not real, but you can, like, you might not be able to put words, but you like can tell.
Yeah.
And like, it's just all because of what we've seen. It's like, we've seen the real for so long that you can identify counterfeit so easily now. And, you know, that's how some people actually are trained in counterfeit.
Right. Yeah. Know the real thing so well. So what film of 2018 would you say had the best visual effects?
I guess I'm more impressed with things that I'm not paying attention to. So for example, I guess how far like Disney Pixar movies have come. Seeing the level of detail that they're putting in their films now at this point is like, it really is like it, because they've honed the 3D skill so well that they're able to go this extra level of detail that if anyone is just looking at it and sees it, it's like, it looks like every single blade of grass was like thought out almost in a way, because they took something, you know, they've been doing it for so long, and they've really crafted this skill. They've got to a point to where not only can they make things look really realistic, they make things intentionally like characterized that makes sense.
And it's cool when you can compare sequels that are years apart,
like
Incredibles 2 to Incredibles, or Finding Dory to Finding Nemo, and see how far. Toy Story is probably the most obviously noticeable, since Toy Story was the first, and you compare what Toy Story 3 looks like, you know.
Yeah. And it's because I, to be honest with you, like I hadn't really followed. I don't really follow the Disney or Pixar films. Like, I hear the films that they're making. Part of it is too, like, I was way over the sequels a long time ago when Disney, you know, was doing the sequels even before, or then, and DreamWorks was doing them, like, before, like, it was just more business related. And then I was like, oh my goodness, it's like Pixar was the last company I thought would do something. Like, I understand certain franchises, like Toy Story,
but keep coming up with,
but it's like, yeah, but it's like, now it's, you can, you know, it's one thing to have one or two kind of sequels that keep going because they're Hallmark stuff, you know, they're just like Toy Story is like, that was like a huge 3D phenomenon that really set the bar for 3D character, 3D movies, 3D animated movies, like full CG movies. So, but now when they're just like, like you start seeing third and fourth ones, like I think they, you know, Cars was killed. I was okay kind of like with Nemo, but like it's like I wouldn't be, you know, going from Nemo to Dory, but I was a little bummed out. I like Incredibles was my favorite Pixar movie, actually still my favorite 3D fully animated film. So I was a little,
you didn't like the second one?
I thought it was okay. I thought it was good.
Yeah,
I mean, but I again I thought it was like, I would have much rather have seen a new film than, you know, the same characters in a different. It was great. It was funny. It was, you know, amazing CG. But it, you know, it wasn't the wow factor that the first Incredibles was, as far as like what I got out of it.
So you went to Ringling School of Design, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Ringling. They changed the name to Ringling College of Design.
No. Okay, and why did you decide to study there?
I actually, because I, you know, growing up in Minnesota, I really, you know, because I knew what I wanted to do, I had a leg up on, I feel like, a lot of people just starting out, because I didn't waste a lot of time. I went right into whatever was available locally, which was, at the time, it was one of the better technical schools to just learn about animation. And the problem was, by the time I entered into it, after we graduated, the school kind of lost. It was really big in the 90s when animation was just becoming popular. They adapted the program, and so they were cutting edge. But after 6, 7, 8 years of not keeping up with the times, they really fell to the wayside of other colleges in 3D. This was the time when like Pixar and DreamWorks were competing, and so like you'd see like this is basically, that's kind of the stuff that, you know, was cool to do, cool to animate. But I was definitely more on the realistic side. So like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, you know, battle, epic kind of stuff was more kind of up my alley. Again, the Jurassic Park, laying the seed. So that kind of stuff. It wasn't so much cartoony, although that was, stuff was really cool and interesting. There was such a, like, I guess this painted picture of, if you got an animation, you just automatically assumed you're going to go for Disney, because that was just the place to work for. I always kind of thought that as being cool, but it was more so put on me than I think I wanted. But I loved Disney. I loved all the movies, and I loved, you know, if there's ever was an ever opportunity to work for them, wouldn't be like I'd say no. I started off at this tech school that, again, it was difficult because I felt like I was ahead of the game. So the first year was just kind of like, oh, I just, you know, getting through this to get to stuff that I don't know and focus on, you know, learning more. So I took 2 years there, and I was really not happy with the result. Like, my, basically what you come out of with college in that field as a demo reel. And that demo reel, I was like, yeah, this is okay. But I like started comparing it to other people in the profession and especially other schools, like what are they coming out with? And so while I was in my final year, a professor at the college I was at in Minnesota was like showing all of us these student demo reels at like the school. And I'm like Ringling Circus, you know, Brothers. I was like, oh, that's cool. And it had a related kind of thing with the circus. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So, because I always loved to do magic and juggling and that kind of stuff. But so after seeing their demo reels, I'm like, this stuff is like Pixar quality. Like, this is really good. And it's like, I immediately made a decision. I was like, if I'm going to keep pursuing this, I need to go to the best college or at least strive for the best, because that's kind of, it wasn't even about being the best. It was like, I really, if I'm going to challenge myself and not sit here and try to learn it on my own or someone, it was really hard to get someone to push you in a good way to learn something. It was more like I had to go where everyone was going in order to get that kind of level. So I looked at that school and I looked at Academy of Art San Francisco, because those were apparently the two top schools. I ended up applying to Ringling first because I think their program cutoff date was first. And I didn't even bother applying to Academy of Art. I was kind of like, I'm just going to go to Ringling. I felt like it was better for 3D. I loved the idea that I was in Florida. And, you know, like we ended up going to visit the college and I was like, this is like perfect. I didn't even end up applying towards the other school. Ended up getting into Ringling. And basically like it was really kind of like this, it was just a great experience overall, excuse me, but for looking back, I think that, you know, not going too far down the rabbit hole of education and how I felt like about it, ultimately it definitely was like the, you know, great career move, a great move for going into animation. It really set me up for like the best chances of getting out of college in order to be successful at a high level right away, which kind of led me to accelerate my career path, just fast track it because of what the school provided. That was kind of in a way that was, even though the school was really expensive because it was, you know, private art school, the price tag on it made sense to me. Like the return on investment for going to the school made sense because of what I was going to come out with, actually way more than I thought it was, not only monetary, but in the fact that it was like just relationships, the connections with people, the it wasn't even like lifelong friends or anything like what we had, but like the networking ability and what that was looking like as far as like knowing people in the industry, because it was like you're friends with the class that just graduated, they all just got jobs, so they're all communicating with underclassmen. And so it's a very close knit group of friends, and it really is a small industry, so small of an industry that it is so common to just run into people on a constant basis, specifically in this niche of a like group of people, of animators specifically. So
you're happy that you went there, and you recommend other people go in there?
I'm happy that I went there. My recommendation is a little complicated, because it's, you know, if you have the means and it makes sense and financially it's, you know, like you really understand that when you go into the school, what you're coming out with and you make something of it, then go for it. But if you aren't quite there yet, like as far as knowing this is what you want, even when you say you're sold out for this and this is what you want, you know, you're still going to come out of that school with, you know, an astronomical debt. That is a art field that is very not very forgiving. So if you aren't pursuing something to the fullest, you can't really go through the motion to try and make a living out of it, because it's either you're in or you're out. And working part-time jobs isn't going to take care of like the bills, because you come out, it's a very serious debt that if you do it right, it sets you up very successfully. But it's just like any other, I would recommend it, or I would say that it's just like any other education. It's what you put into it that you're going to get out of it. And if anything, the price that you're paying for the school, like, you know, man, it's probably just crazy expensive right now. So again, like, it's a lot more complicated, because I don't know if I would go to the school now, knowing what I know about education, because a lot of education is you actually pushing yourself to learn while you're in school.
Yeah.
And that always kind of bothered me, because I was always having to self-teach myself anyways. So I always wanted a curriculum that was setting me up to where I had someone where I could constantly be learning. But I made it that where other people didn't. I made it where I would contact professors, have a real relationship with them that was like mentor, you know, master apprentice type relationships. And I feel like that is definitely how college should be approached. If you're just going through the motion just to get your degree, I can almost guarantee you it's going to be really hard after to try and make anything of it that has any significance into what you want to do, only because the real learning is actually in not you trying to teach yourself, but in partnering with people and like picking their brains and having access to their gifts and resources, which most people don't even think about to take advantage of, because they feel like, oh, I'm just at the school, so therefore
I'll get what I need.
Yeah, I'm getting what I need. I'm checking the box and I'm good. But it is very clear who is going to make it and who's not at the end of the year.
Was there any time while you were in school that you thought, oh, maybe I don't want to do this? Or were you always kind of fully sold on it?
No, I was actually fully sold, and I was told many times that you might experience this. I was always warned about burnout in the industry, and so I was always kind of more on guard for that. But the way I approached my career was with such passion that it wasn't even an option, really. It wasn't even like a thought that I was like, I was going to get burned out in something that I love. But when I realized what the true meaning was, like, of what that looked like, I was like, all it is all you got to do is just create a balance in your life. I was like, but that's with anything.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, okay, well, you know, I have a whole bunch of hobbies. So I'm not just doing this. But I could see people who were more passionate than me, almost like obsessive about it, where that's all they did was live, breathe, and like have no other outside life. And I'm, you know, that's a awesome thing to do. But if that's, you know, comes down to like if that's your identity and you don't make it, it can be really crushing and destroy you. And it just, you know, it's not a good thing. But if you keep doing it and you are doing something in the industry that ends up not being for you, but you still love it, that's how you can, you know, equally get burned out. And I actually experienced burnout later on, and it was, you know, a similar thing where I got to a point to where you know, I was just doing the art for the art's sake, and not, there was no creativity whatsoever. It was like, this is what we have to do, create this, do that, get paid, and that was it. And it was like, repeat that.
Yeah.
So
what was your first gig in the industry out of school, and how did you get it?
I guess out of Ringling, I was very fortunate enough to, again, this was because of the way that I approached it. While I was in school, a professor that I was really close with, who was the animation teacher who I had for 2 years, and as a junior, I had already started building this relationship with him that was like again, like a master apprentice thing, like showing him like, hey, I'm willing to go the extra mile if you're willing to, you know, teachers love that because they're in it in the education field because there's something about teaching that they get passionate about. Mm-hmm. So like it just totally makes sense to me to seek that out. So like I had this relationship that was, you know, kind of like critiquing extra at like an extra level, like doing stuff outside of what the normal homework assignments were, that he would, you know, give advice and like look at things and give great, you know, just advice in life and what to like start kind of looking for. So he actually did freelance work outside of the college. And so he was able to, he just asked me because I had taken, you know, those 2 years in Minnesota, I was able to have like my last 2 years be pretty low level as far as like workload. Mm. I was just focusing on the specialty courses for the degree. So I took a couple like independent studies, and one of them was like with him, where I got to just work on whatever I wanted to, animation related. And so he actually, at the beginning of the class of the year, he proposed, he's like, dude, like I used to work at Real Effects, company based out of Dallas, Texas. And they offered me this freelance job opportunity to work on the Looney Tunes shorts. And I asked if I could have you work on it too. And I was, at first I was just like, oh my goodness, this is an amazing opportunity. Like, of course. And then like, he's like, and you'll get paid. And I'm like, what? I was like, so it's like, basically you're offering me a job. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, so like, he put me in touch with the producers there. And this is while I'm in school working on my thesis, but I was already given the opportunity to work. So that was technically my first job.
And those Looney Tunes shorts were going in front of theatrical releases, right? What was it?
Yeah, they told me, I forgot what the first one was. They told me the movies that they were going to play in front of. And I was like, oh man, this is so cool. So, cause it was like a theatrical released short. So not only was it just a short, but it was going to be on the big screen. So right. That's like everyone's dream.
Yeah.
To see, you know, like your name on the big screen. I knew that one of them was going to play, cause I ended up doing three of them. And I know the second one played in front of the Guardians of Gahool, the owl movie. Mm-hmm. I'm drawing a blank on the first and third one, but they were released similar ways, just in front of.
Do you remember that feeling of going to the theater and seeing your name up there for the first time?
Yeah, it was definitely surreal. But here's the thing, it was like it was what I had been visualizing for a long time. So it wasn't, what was surreal about it was I had already envisioned that this was going to happen. So it wasn't a shock or a surprise. It was like, yeah, I already kind of knew that at some point this was going to happen. Mm. It just happened a lot sooner than later. And then sitting there actually seeing what you had visualized on the big screen as like, you know, your name rolls up and the credits are slowly crawling by and you're just like, it's like a cheering kind of like moment. But it was kind of just a great more of like, not I achieved this, but there's so much more to go. Like, I feel like I'm just getting started. So it was a great kind of feeling to kind of propel. So that led into continuing to work with Real Effects after I graduated. And it was really weird after I graduated because everyone is, because I went to Ringling, I was considered non-traditional because I had 2 years of college already. I was 21 starting over in a 4-year program. So I was older than most kids coming in. So when I was leaving the outside of the college, I definitely treated college as if it was the job. It was like a profession. And it was like, I was going in and it was great because their program was developed in that kind of way. It was like, you're going to be in like animation boot camp. It's like, this is, you're getting an assignment as if you were in real life. going through the full, you know, like the teacher is the client and they're giving you notes and you're doing it and you're finishing it. And like you go through the whole process of making a short film. So, after graduation, there's this is weird kind of time where everyone is vying for the best opportunity, the best company. And like, you really find out who your real friends are, who's talking about you. And like, you know, cause it brings out competition in art school kids, which is a really funny kind of thing because it's like everyone is very passive aggressive. So it's like, it's so like, you know, like high school-y where it's like dealing with conflict. So for me, you know, when you'd get called in for an interview or your name would be on a list for interview and your friend didn't get it or it happened to you, you're like, what does this kid got that I don't? Like, you just get very like kind of competitive. But how you just approach those relationships afterward, because school is still going on like half the year, or at least the last few months for sure. And you're sitting next to the kid who got the interview, but you didn't. And you're just like, how do you keep the same conversation with this person that you're like, dude, I'm so much better than you at this. And then they're getting interviews and it's, you know, it's kind of, it was kind of funny, but I had a lot of opportunities because of the real effects thing. And thankfully what happened was a lot of, doors were closed in a good way that led me to go to California. I originally was going to accept an offer from Sony that would have led me into Albuquerque, New Mexico to work on Green Lantern. And they were like, you know, you're going to get LA rates. And it was like a good contract. And like, I'm fresh out of school. So I thought this was a good deal. I knew two of my friends that were, that got the deal. And there's something about it where I was just like, I don't, this, like, I'm not going to California. And that was my, I was like, I thought that's where I was going to go. And because I had the experience with real effects, there was two things that happened. One was that I kind of was like, this is, I think I can get paid more than this. And I wasn't like I was going out for the money, but when you have a giant student loan debt, things become a lot more real financially. So the amount that they were giving me, I was making more than that with real effects. So I was, and like, I didn't know how to negotiate. There was nothing like, there's no leverage whatsoever when you're coming fresh out of school. Because they just say, what do you mean? You don't, you know, like even with your real effects experience that I, you know, bring that up, it didn't mean anything to them. You know, the reason why they're there recruiting is because they can get artists for really cheap, basically. And so I kind of saw that that was what was happening. So I turned it down thinking too that maybe they'll come back with a higher offer, but they didn't. And I was like, at first I was like, dang, did I just shoot myself in the foot? What just happened? But thankfully, again, like I had the real effects job already. So it wasn't like I was desperate. And I'm so glad that that didn't happen, because later finding out like the two friends I went there, they were basically stranded out there after the movie wrapped in like a few months and they had nothing to show for. The movie doesn't come out for another like year. So they basically have nothing they can put on their resume besides saying they worked at Sony, but no one cares where you work. They want to see what you did or what you're capable of. And so I saved money working in Minnesota freelance for real effects. For the summer, I was making way more money than what Sony was offering me. So I was like happy. And I worked half the time and made maybe like double, triple what I thought I was going to make. And I remember the first time, it was basically my, so working for real effects was my first job legitimately out of Ringling school. So I remember going in, because so I had just finished the last short for the Looney Tunes and they're like, we're gonna put you in touch with our commercial producer because we have a commercial that we want to like put you on, and their rates are different. So feature film rates compared to like commercial, like you start giving a day rate and you just work for the day. It's just kind of like that's how they work. And I was like, I asked my teacher again, this is where the relationship came in. I was so open with him. I was like, dude, like I don't know what my freelance rate would be. Like, what should I charge? I don't want to sound like, you know, like I'm charging too much. I also don't want to like lowball and, you know, just be taken advantage of. Cause I could see a lot of my peers were being taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. So he like straight up told me like, this is what you should charge. This is there. He told him, these are what my rates are. So like you can kind of do the math, figure out like where you would fall. And so I told them a price thinking, you know, just naturally business, they would come down a little. And it was something like $300 a day. And the teacher was like I think like $500 a day, but this was, you know, a while ago. Mm. And he's like, that's just my freelance rate. And I was like, you can break it down however you want, $50 an hour or whatever it would be. But so like, I just threw out this number and they're like, great, we'll do it at $300 a day. And I like without even a blink in their eye, they already agreed to it. And I'm just like, what just happened? And I remember I was about to go to the gym and my drive to the gym, it was still like setting in. And I was like, dude, I just got a job for $300 a day doing what I love to do. And like, I started doing the math on my phone and I was like, $300 a day. And I like got to the gym and I'm like still thinking in my head, $300 a day. I'm going to get $300 a day. And I'm like, dude, I just won the lottery. It was so awesome. I was like, oh my goodness. It's like this. And like, obviously at that time, like $300 a day was a lot of money. It was a lot more than I thought that I would be getting. Mm. And starting out, like it was great. And yeah, that's why I was like, again, I was really blown away with how like two things, how students can get taken advantage of right out of school. And then also like but there's a lot of potential to make like serious money. And I wasn't even in it for the money. It was more like, I now be able to pay for things, you know, like afford, you know, my student loan bill. And cause that's so abstract at that point, when you're talking about $100,000, you're just, you know, every year it's like thousands of dollars that you're signing this loan.
Yeah.
That you're just like tens of thousands of dollars. You're like, yeah, one day I'll take care of that. You just completely put it off. But yeah, that was Real Effects actually did me a big favor in multiple ways, but it all started with that one teacher.
And then you came out to LA and I remember, I don't remember how long it was, but there was a good chunk of time there. We were both unemployed. You know, I'm freelance editing. You're looking for VFX stuff, but we're both kind of like just living this, like go to the gym every day.
Just bums.
Yeah. And we're both like trying to find something.
Yeah.
What was that first movie that you ended up getting? Was it The Double? Was that?
Yeah. I think that was the first feature film. And it's so funny because like I remember that time as being the most like difficult, because I just moved out here to California, knew a lot of people, had a lot of interviews, but nothing was happening. Mm-hmm. And like later finding out, you know, like in the industry there's, you know, highs and lows for job hirings and stuff, and like everything is very seasonal, and that particular time of the season was difficult, especially for entry level positions. Most industries entry level stuff is starting more beginning of the year when budgets are new, projects are green lighting, or in the spring when again they're targeting people right out of college, so they're, you know, ready to go, but you know they'll go into like a, you know, apprentice programs or internships or something that's like a lot
seemingly paid. when you're looking at the credits for a big like a Marvel movie and you're seeing all these names of CG artists, it seems like there's just more than any other type of job that you could do in the industry, there would be so many opportunities for CG artists, but at the same time it's still a bunch of people fighting for all those jobs. It still seems like a hard, like, are there not as many as it there's it seems?
It kind of changed when I came out here to California. The outsourcing had already kind of started happening, going to other countries. Mm-hmm. So that had a big, that was really kind of a hard, you know, position to be in, because a lot of people were able to get the jobs, not even by their skill level. It was just that they're getting paid an extremely low amount of money. So there wasn't, those jobs were already locked up basically. Mm-hmm. So what you were competing with was, there's definitely a lot of opportunity, a lot, you know, hundreds and hundreds of artists that are involved with making a film, a big film. But it's all just like a kind of just patience and timing mm-hmm. for a lot of it, because it's a, because of the sheer volume of work that is in this industry, it's just a matter of time before that happened. And then once you kind of got in, you start keeping up appearances. You were kind of like in, mm-hmm. You started developing relationships with producers and stuff, but people like it easy. So like very rarely did anyone get hired because of their resume. It was all because they knew someone.
Yeah.
And it was always a networking, and, you know, found that out even later, how important that was. Like, you know, again, it didn't have a lot to do with skill. It had more to do with, is this person trustworthy? Is he a good artist? Is, you know, 'cause there's a lot of people that were able to show really good demo reels, but just didn't have the chops to really just actually do the job the way that it needed to be done. Like mm-hmm. not having to be handheld the whole way. Some of that has to do with confidence, but yeah, when it really came down to the amount of work that needed to be done, it was just a matter of patience and timing for that to happen.
As far as being a freelance artist who's hopping around to different films, or just being an employee at a visual effects house, I feel like you kind of have done both, right? Mm-hmm. What are the differences there, and what do you, when people talk to you, what do you recommend them trying to go for?
I actually wrote a whole like article kind of post to a few people about the pluses and minuses. I was really, again, very blessed to have this opportunity with Real Effects that opened the door to independent contracting and freelance. Mm-hmm. And if I had taken that Sony job, I would have fallen into kind of a little bit more of the corporate job, as far as like working for a company and not really having the freedoms and flexibilities as a freelance artist does. And I highly, highly, highly recommend to most people to start off as freelance, for many reasons, but the main reason is because if you really want to achieve a level of success in this industry, it's kind of a prerequisite in order to do that, because you learn so much more about the industry and how to be successful as being a freelance artist, as opposed to just going in with a company and, you know, going through the motions, just kind of another gear in the cog machine that's just cranking out work. And again, a lot of it, I always just come back to it, it's a lot of it is just personality. Mm-hmm. For me personally, I recommend freelance, but if your personality is like Disney, 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 all I want to do is Disney. I love Disney. I eat, sleep, and breathe Disney. I know every Disney song. Mm-hmm. I know I got everything memorized, every character. I'll beat you at Disney trivia, everything. And then you go for Disney and you get the job with Disney and you're happier than a clam. This is like the best thing. Like, of course, go for that. Like, yeah. That's what's going to make you happy. Then go for it. But just know that that's it. You know, a lot of people that I know that get to where they want to be, and this happened to me, is like when you reach that level, it's like there's this moment of like, now what? Like, I kind of achieved what I wanted to, but then it's like kind of like this, you know, I don't have anything else to live for in my career. It's like I kind of achieved what I wanted to. So you have to kind of set new goals, but freelance is a healthy way to avoid that. Obviously, there's a lot of risks and stuff involved, but the advantages for me far outweighed the disadvantages or the cons to going into that. Hmm. And I, like I went through all that kind of in the article, and most people can figure it out right away if that's for them or not. I remember going in college and just kind of like, I don't really want to be like business savvy. I just want a job and I just want to do what I want to do and have fun doing it. Mm. But I kind of was naive and ignorant to the fact of how important it was to have that, and felt like if that was one thing in college that I needed more of, like speaking into that area was definitely necessary, because I think, like, I would say just as my own guess is probably like 75% of students coming out of college, or specifically Ringling, were probably starting in freelance, but they didn't know that they were going to, or they didn't even think of that as like an option. Yeah. But the majority of jobs out of college are all freelance, starting freelance. If it's not freelance, it's temporary, like permalance, where it's like you're with a company. Not a lot of companies did long-term contracts anymore, or employee contracts for that matter. Very few. Even like the big companies that everyone was shooting for, you know, there's still
weren't given full-time.
Well, it was always still a period of time where it was this illusion of a job, and where it was like, once the project's done and we don't have anything for you to work on, we can let you go.
Right.
So it was really not much different than being freelance. It was just this, you know,
consistency for the period, but then
I mean, their hope is to wrap, you know, roll you on to the next project, because it saves them money and time to try and hire people, find people, trust people, because it's very expensive for a company to hire and then not get the product they want out of it and go through the process again. It can be very expensive for them. So
over the past few years, now you're working more as a supervisor, right, rather than an animator. What is that difference like for you? And do you enjoy that more now as a supervisor, or do you miss being one of the animators?
No, I think I definitely enjoy it more. I think that, again, like, so going through at a getting into the career I became what I wanted to be in, it was pretty much the first year out of school, I achieved what I wanted to, like, in like 5 years, I thought I would be 5 to 10 years, somewhere in there. Like 10 years, I'd be like, oh man, that'd be awesome if I could do that. 10 years, like 5 years, oh, that's, would be amazing. So I fast tracked it into supervising animation the first year that I got out of college. And so then I was doing it at a higher level, and right away I loved it, because it's you go from like literally juggling like two balls into like 17 balls. Like it's part of that is like what makes the job fun. So anytime like I am losing track of time at work is like a good sign for me, where it's just like, oh my goodness, my day went by so fast, and like I got this done. But I love where there's so many different things going on at once that is creative. You don't get stuck into the same thing trying to work something out or problem solving this one thing. So it's, and you're dealing with whole sequences, not just one shot. So it's like you're looking at things from a little further perspective. There's a lot more managerial skills that come in that are really, for me, really fun, because it's like problem solving, putting together a puzzle, and like looking, planning things and putting things ahead. So it's, you know, that's a really fun aspect to it. It's basically using my full potential as opposed to just one small section that, you know, I could, you know, be really good at, specialized in. But now I'm not, it's like a person that a superhero that can only use one of his superhero abilities, and it's like, oh, I have so much more that I can do. And it's, you know, it's very fulfilling. It makes supervising role. I mean, there's times where it is very stressful and so I do it. And there was a time where I went back into just an artist role, and I had forgotten what that was. And I really loved it. It was this great time to just be an artist again and shut off that supervising brain for a while, because it is a good kind of rest, especially when you got other things, you know, in your life that are, you know, stressful and pressure, and just the pressures of life come up. It's a good time sometimes to just be in that position where you can just focus on one thing and shut everything else off. So
even now in your position, mostly supervising, you'll still go back to being an artist depending on what they need you to help with.
So with the studio I'm with now, they contract me as a supervisor, but they don't always have there's always a transition period, or there's a kind of a waiting period for when the next project would be. So when you wrap on one film, you know, it's not always the right timing to go right into the next. Sometimes you just have to finish what you're on, even though something was ready for you. It's pretty rare that you're just going to roll you off into the next film without just finishing the job. So getting back into the artist role is a nice change of pace, but it definitely, you can become complacent and not using your full potential. And then you kind of have this like laziness that comes up, and it's just not good, because like it's easy to stay in. It's kind of like a trap that you don't want to be stuck in. But at some point also just feels like you're not being creative and using your full potential. So you kind of get frustrated at some point where you're just like, I have, you know, nothing to do with like, you know, ego or pride that you have more to offer, but it's more just satisfaction in what you're doing as a job. Because if you're going to a job where you're not feeling you're being used to your full potential, then you just kind of don't feel satisfied.
So I know with NDAs, you can't discuss things that you're working on that haven't come out yet. What's the latest thing that you can talk about that you worked on that you could,
thing is like,
are you not sure which ones you can?
No, I mean, so that's the thing is like, it's hard because like the latest, like I technically can't say anything until, the film is released and I get permission. Most times, because the film has been released, the credits have been released officially through the studio. So they'll see, the company that actually worked for it.
Gotcha.
I mean, it's films are like 2 years out in the pre-visualization process. So like, I think the next film that I've worked on that comes out is probably in a couple months.
But the last one that came out, how far back was that? Was it Pan?
Yeah, Pan. So yeah, that one was a long time ago, but then I was into commercials for 3 years. So I hadn't worked, 2 years after Pan. So I hadn't been in the feature film world for a while. And that was, again, just touching back on just becoming burned out. Because at that point, I literally achieved everything that I'd set out to do. Being in animation, supervising animation at a high level, feature film, working with directors, working with cinematographers, working with producers, having, you know, the dream come true of being where you want to, working on like great projects. They weren't necessarily ones that I'd wanted to be on, but they turned out, you know, great, or something that I was like proud of to show or to be excited about. So there was this period of time where I was like, now that I've kind of done what I wanted to do, like at this point, it's just like a means to an end to get paid, which is a really tough situation to be in when you have family and kids and responsibilities, like, and then financial things. So what was good was I recognized it, that I was getting burnt out. So I wasn't okay with it. I wanted change. And it was just kind of like waiting for the opportunity to come up. That was like, so I ended up finding a position just from someone that reached out to me who I knew, networking. It was literally kind of like a, you know, open door, just be like, you know, God just serving this up on a silver platter. It's like, here you go. It's what you've been praying for. And it's like, so it was very easy. It was like, definitely felt like I was just being led, got the job, you know, and it has just been the best company I have worked for or partnered with, basically, I should say, just best company I've been partnering with. And, yeah, they're a lot stricter on NDAs. And I, you know, I respect that. It's just harder while you're in the company, not being able to talk it with other colleagues, even that is kind of like, oh, that's kind of a little much, but okay. I kind of get it. So, I mean, there's people that when you're not a supervisor, you don't get access to seeing all the shows basically and who's working on it. So, and it's like, if you know someone who's working on a film, it's like they have reference and stuff like around them. It's like pretty easy to figure it out. But, yeah, it's the NDA thing. I just got to deal with it. It is what it is. I can't really allude to too much.
That's right.
Unfortunately.
Last thing, another highlight that I want you to talk about is working on Noah. So you did the, I don't know what you called that sequence.
So it was a seven-day creation sequence. Mm-hmm. It comes about 2/3 of the way into the movie.
It's the coolest thing in that film. And you got to work with, did you work directly with Aronofsky in formulating that?
It wasn't like he wasn't the one that, I mean, he was the one ultimately making the decisions.
Yeah.
But really it was, the writer. And he actually had, he was very, I think he had like a degree in like neuroscience or something that was like, is, you know, it was pretty prestigious to have like this background in this kind of field of science. I love the idea of like they didn't know what this would look like or how to visualize this, but I loved the way they went about it. That wasn't like you'd say Christian based or like have like roots in any kind of religion, really. It was like, and it wasn't, definitely wasn't an atheist point of view, even though it had to do with evolution, but we know that evolution is just like, you know, there's micro and macro. But it was the idea of visualizing something that was like logically made sense. So even, you know, when miracles happen, it might not be explained, but there's still, you know, like visualizing something like the Big Bang, or we'll just say visualizing something like a miraculous healing, and you can't explain like how that happened, but you can kind of get behind a visualization of it. And so like that's kind of the way they approached it, where it was like, let's really study science and like get everyone's opinion, expert opinion, not like really in the scientific community, whether it was I didn't even care about religion or whatever it would be. And it was really like, which story that this scientist is saying what this would look like. There's tons of different points of view, even just how the moon was formed, you know, like no one was here to witness that. So it was only, you can only kind of piece it together the way that, you know, makes sense, and certain sciences unlock that and explain it basically. But there's some science that still can't be explained, So what was the most interesting thing about it was, for example, like how they could, like when was it when the creature developed the eye? You know, like at what point was that? And in this sequence, it kind of like happens really quickly. Mm. But they really did their due diligence in trying to make this thing based on all the evidence that they have right now, evidence, the science, everything around it. They tried to make it as realistic as possible of what this would really look like with still kind of like a style to it. And so the experience of the film, so I got to work, the writer was Ari Handel, and he literally came to the studio and sat with us to help push us in directions that we needed it to go. And their his whole thing, because he's a writer, was storytelling. So he wasn't so because it was previs at that time, we were doing the previs for it, visualizing what this was. It was so awesome to literally craft the look of the piece, of the sequence, like before anyone could ever understand what we're after. I mean, like basically we kind of got a concept of it where it was like, we want to see this one-er shot where it's just like pushing in, like through past space and time and arriving at like Earth and like getting all the way down to this ground level. And while you're making this, you know, amazing journey, that all these like thousands, millions of years are passing, like frame by frame, like every frame is like thousands of years going by in this, you know, kind of stutter effect. But it's, you know, it was the concept is like thousands of years passing by in evolution as things are being created. And, you know, like, how do you visualize that? Where do you start? What is like there's so many different ways to visualize the Big Bang. Everyone's like, you know, thinking of the most obvious, and like they went completely unconventional, kind of like the same way that, the other space movie Interstellar kind of approached science with the black hole, you know, thing. And so it was this idea that it wasn't just like this, you know, single point that just erupted in this giant white, you know, void. It was like this interesting effect that we had to come up with that was basically just, you know, thought out because of this theory of what, where we were evidence wise of what it could look like. The same way with how the moon was created, how like an asteroid smashed in to the Earth while the Earth was still like forming after, you know, the Big Bang, or even after our universe. There's still so many things that are like unknown, but they kind of did a good, you know, smart thing to not do too much in the sequence, where it was just like key things we want to just show. It was like really focusing in at, like, no one knows exactly how like all the Milky Way and everything was like created. Again, like you could guess just based on what we know, but like they didn't focus on that. Like it just blew past the Big Bang and like probably the most important times of how Earth became before all of that. And so the way that they visualize, you know, the moon was a big deal. So like we really worked that section out, and there's a lot of choreography that is involved with that. The effect of thousands of years going by was kept kind of being put off. It was kind of like, it kind of looks like stop motion effect, or maybe just like a weird shutter speed, or if this thing is on ones or twos, like animated in a weird way, or, you know, it just kept getting pushed off. It was just like, let's just tell the story first, like how this is going to work, you know. And there's, you know, really cool ways that aren't, obviously no one's going to appreciate just how the moon is going around and eclipses with the sun in a certain way, and the way that was with how it all just aligns. Like, everything was intentional, science-based, which was really appreciated by all of us as an artist, because we were like, hey, this is what we're striving. This is the vision. Let's make that happen. Mm-hmm. So we did a lot of back and forth with him, which was really cool, really, you know, low key, down to earth guy. He's like, dude, just call me on my cell phone if you need anything. So it was like, access to him was really cool. And so we ended up, you know, doing the whole sequence and getting to the place of where I, you know, creating the look for how this evolution process was going to work, especially without it being distracting and just like, you know, hard to follow, because it's a lot when you have thousands of years of things changing and evolving. There's a certain, you know, there's certain things you can get away with, certain things that are, you just can't without having someone have a seizure like watching this. So, but it was definitely, I feel like, my most influential thing that I brought to the big screen, as far as like a art form, like the way the animals are moving, the way that they're changing and evolving from one species to the next, all that was like, you know, tested and planned and like, you know, more testing and like, what that looks like, what that, you know, just kind of like visualizing that whole process was like multiple different ways to do that. Like how the animal is just moving mechanically for it to work properly, how it is changing like completely different forms at one point from, you know, like from a sea animal to a land animal, different textures, and it's like hair and like tails, and you know, so there's all these like, you know, little things that needed to be thought out.
Thank you, Mitch. That sequence from Noah, the creation sequence, is amazing. You gotta check it out. Go online and look it up right away. Thanks for listening to the show. If you are a fan, please go on iTunes and give us a good review. That really would really help us out. And follow us on Twitter, follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.